I have a question.
Yes.
Yeah, how are you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing better. I'm taking another antibiotic. I had a urine test and have another urinary tract infection. So I'm taking something called Cipro something or other. What is it called, Linda? You know these Cipro something.
And I always just call it Cipro.
Cipro. And they're taking a culture to see if there might be some antibiotic that will be more addressing the particular bacteria that are in my urinary tract, UTI, urogenitalium. But generally, I'll be finishing radiation on December 29th if the schedule goes as planned. And just feeling a little bit fatigue.
Aww.
And, urinary tract infection, constipation, fatigue. But my, the famous story of the Buddha, I'm not putting myself in any category like that, but the famous story of the Buddha, when he took the aspect of having a fever, I say that because in the Mahayana, it's believed that the Buddha would never have, because the Buddha's body was an emanation of light, but he took the aspect of having a fever, and while he was lying down and people were putting cold compresses on his head and massaging his body, they said, "How are you feeling?" And the Buddha said, "There are great waves of pain coursing through the Buddha's body," speaking of himself in the third person, right, kind of the king, like, through the Buddha's body, "but his mind is at ease." So that's something we can all aspire to, right? That whatever is happening, that even if we have some kind of something uncomfortable happening to us, we can try to remember the Dharma to the best of our extent and meditate on Tonglen, on emptiness, on the nature of suffering, and calm the mind, try to have a little bit of Dharma happiness. So thanks for asking.
Yes.
Okay, we've got 35 seconds. I'll try to start right on time. So I hope everyone's well. It's a little bit cold here. I'm in a town called Weaverville that's north of Asheville, 5 minutes from the radiation center, and an Airbnb. So the heat is on. Can you hear the fan in the background? Is it? No? Okay. Okay.
No.
Okay. There's a, you know how the forced air, I was thinking to turn it off, but the lady of the house said, don't turn it off.
Zoom is very good at screening out background sounds.
Oh, okay. That's good to know. Okay. Good to see you. There may be some other people joining us. I'm sure there will. This is the Wednesday night class of Geshe-la. I am giving him a chance to have a staycation, as you know. And so this we're studying the text on composed by Pabonka Rinpoche. Does it show up? Why is it not? My body disappears. Oh, there it is.
There it is. You have to have it. Yeah,
I have
right.
To hold it right in front of the camera or something like that. There it is. Anyway, you know the book I'm talking about. It's not Pabonka Rinpoche's Liberation in the Palm. It is another discourse that he gave, and notes were taken. He didn't compose either of these texts. He gave lectures, which were then, there was an attempt at transcription. People took notes, and this is the result of that. And we're in the section on the benefits of bodhicitta. So to begin, we're going to do a little meditation to set a motivation as close as we can to bodhicitta. And my system, my tradition, or whatever you want to call it, has been to, we meditate slowly through gross level, watching the breathing, which is common to the Mahayana and the Theravada. And then we move to meditation on the mind, but in particular, recognizing the clear light nature of the mind. So sit comfortably. relax your body, relax your mind. Watch your breathing, recognize it, pay attention to it. And once you've paid attention, it is a suitable object to be mindful of. As the people who are studying mind and mental factors know, mindfulness is a mental factor that keeps something which has already been realized in mind. Watch the breathing to the exclusion of everything else. Let go of other thoughts. Just add the wisdom factor of recognizing when you're breathing in and when you're breathing out. Use a little bit of mental spy, kind of introspection, to watch if other thoughts that you're giving energy to other thoughts, that you're paying attention to them. If you are, take your attention away from them, invest them, that energy into the awareness, the mindfulness of the breathing. Let those other thoughts disappear. You can kind of continually reset, relaxing your body, remembering that you don't have to pay attention to other thoughts. Here you're not trying to control the breathing, you're just watching it. As it becomes more calm, more regular, and more shallow, take a mental snapshot of that quality of the mind that we'll compare with the breathing later when we meditate on the clear light nature. Now, if the mind has become a little bit calm, withdraw your attention away from the breathing, withdraw your mindfulness from the breathing, and instead place it on your mental consciousness. Mental consciousness is something very subtle. doesn't have a shape or form. But we can kind of get an idea of it by the thoughts within it, the contents, the plans about the future, the memories of the past, the observations or thoughts about the present. Mental states of irritation, feelings, pleasure, desire, anger. Whatever contents there are of your mind, notice that they are kind of embedded, or they emerge from the spaciousness of your mind. Its clarity, the quill-like nature of the mind doesn't have a color. It's something that's known by wisdom and gnosis. It has a deep understanding. When I say appearance, it doesn't mean like the appearance to your eye. Recognize that if you withdraw your attention away from any particular cloud-like thought and focus your attention instead on the spaciousness of the mind that allows that thought to be present, the spaciousness of the mind within which that thought has emerged, that the thoughts begin to lose their longevity. If you don't pay attention to them, they begin to fade away. And even if they were to arise again, they become less frequent. This clear-light nature of the mind, conventional clear-light nature of the mind, the fact that it doesn't obstruct thoughts from entering or leaving, it's calm and clear. This is what's also called the conventional Buddha nature, or the developmental Buddha nature, as opposed to, you may have heard another term, the non-abiding Buddha nature, which refers to the emptiness of the mind. This is just the conventional nature of the mind. Knowing that we always have this nature, even when thoughts are tumbling out like over a waterfall, fighting in the sky of our mind, even if there's suffering or ecstasy, whatever, the clear light nature of the mind is what allows those various images to arise within our mind, various thoughts and images, conversations. We have the ability to generate all of the good qualities and eliminate all of the faults that we have heretofore maybe felt, we couldn't develop certain thoughts, we couldn't get rid of certain faults. All of them can be accomplished. We can become a better person, a happier person for ourselves, and more benign relation to other beings. We can become as harmful and eventually even really beneficial. Bringing your attention outward toward other beings, those that you know, at home, at work, in the streets, those that you know of, through newspapers or television or radio, internet, those that you have been told exist, like hell beings and hungry ghosts, those that you can see like animals and insects, various more enjoyable states of mind that are called devas, or only translated as gods, the desire realm, form and formless realm. We may not have a perception of them, but we're told they exist. All these living beings are exactly the same as us in wanting to be happy, wanting to be free of suffering. If, as the Buddha explained, the self that we have grasped to since beginning of this time is some kind of findable, inherently existent, substantially existent kind of entity, if that self that we believed in since beginning of this time and still believe in now, if that doesn't exist, we can begin to identify with the entirety of living beings. They are our bodies. Their feelings are our feelings. And recognizing all these living beings have been intimately kind, depthlessly kind to us, not only in the present, some of them, the moms and dads, brothers and sisters, friends, supporters, even strangers have been kind to us, both now and in past lives. Even our enemies, from a Buddhist perspective, are kind, in not because they have a motivation to benefit us, but because they benefit us. Even the Dharma could be said to be kind because it benefits us. All these living beings that have been our mothers numberless times in the past, depthlessly kind to us and giving us a body, protecting us from harm, giving us enjoyments, food, enjoyments, teaching us from how to go to the toilet, how to keep clean, how to take care of ourselves. Urging us to be good. All of these living beings are still immersed in cyclic existence under the influence of their delusions, afflictions, emotions, kleshas, anger, attachment, ignorance, so forth. Especially they grasp to a kind of self that doesn't really exist, a soul. They're not free. Think how wonderful it would be to repay their kindness of numberless lives. Just like repaying the kindness of our mom or dad this lifetime. Is there in some suffering situation? Equally kind all sentient beings have been equally kind as our present mother. Even though our present mother has been kind numberless times in the past, each and every other sentient being has also. The chance to recognize this is due to the fact that we have created the karma in the past to have a life right now as a human, where we've met the Dharma, still exists, had supporters and friends to help us take the medicine of the Dharma. We have a certain degree of faith and confidence in it, interest in it. This kind of life, the Buddha himself said, was vanishingly rare, so incredibly rare that he called it a life of leisure and endowment. We can give it some accolades, okay? Perfect human rebirth, not one where we've invested all of our life energy into just finding happiness for the here and now, but becoming dubious of the appearances of this life, being willing to undergo certain hardships to avoid creating problems for others, to avoid creating negative karma. All of this is the result of our having this life right now, which itself is impermanent, transitory. Every moment we're rushing toward our eventual death. And we want to make as much use of it for its higher purposes, its highest purpose, which is to, even in this lifetime, perhaps to achieve enlightenment or liberation from samsara, or at least to make a foundation of Dharma realizations that we can carry on, imprints of these realizations that we'll carry on into future lifetimes. So we'll have an innate kindness in future lives, an innate wisdom, an innate desire or interest in being moral and ethical. To be able to do the same, to lead others into that same kind of knowledge, we ourselves have to be on a higher level than them and other sentient beings, to perfectly lead all sentient beings out of problems with Dharma wisdom, not just worldly wisdom, to lead them into everlasting happiness. We ourselves have to have achieved that state of enlightenment. So with this two-pronged thought, one, out of concern for sentient beings, how to repay their kindness, take them out of suffering, lead them into happiness, and recognizing to be able to do that, we must become a Buddha, try to develop the wishing state of bodhicitta, mind that aspires to become enlightened for the very sake of other sentient beings. To practice the bodhisattva path, the tantric path to achieve that, takes a long period of time, takes wisdom, method. And so I think this evening's talk on the stages of the path, especially about bodhicitta, I'm going to participate for that purpose, to accumulate wisdom and methods to be able to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. I'm going to listen to the teachings in order to become enlightened for the sake of all sentient beings. Yeah, just devote yourself that way. This hour and a half, I'm going to devote to listening, contemplating, meditating on the material to get closer to that state of enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. And as my heating system forced air just fans have gone off, bring your attention back to the present. Good to see you all. How are you doing? Anyone have any problems? Patrick, you okay? You have to unmute. I can't hear you.
I'm good.
Good, okay. Susie, you okay? Yeah. Anyone have, Condrill W has, I think, a comment or question.
It's just a comment, Venerable George. I just want to tell you that seeing the merit field behind you and seeing kind of the top of Lama Tsongkhapa's head,
right.
No, just the top, the little, his little yellow hat, peeking out of the crown of your head is just the most wonderful image, and it is giving me great joy. Thank you.
Your great joy gives me great joy also. I remember Lama Tsongkhapa Rinpoche, he translated for Serkon Central Rinpoche once, the great yogi, sort of companion of the Dalai Lama, who was the basis of George Lucas's Yoda, you know, with the big ears, wise. He took some sampa, you know, the Tibetan barley, poured a little tea, made some, what the Tibetans say, pak, sort of like dough, and he molded the hats of all of the pundits. I can't zoom in on the, because I've got a photo behind me, you know, one of these backgrounds. But all of these lamas, most of them have pundit hats on, and Lama Tsongkhapa's pundit hat comes to a very sharp point, and that's supposed to be important in the Gelugpa tradition to symbolize that Lama Tsongkhapa reached the apex of the understanding, the wisdom of emptiness. So the pundit hat coming to the point, you know, sort of symbolizing that. So thanks for your admiration for the hat. Elise, you have a thought also?
Well, I actually have a question.
Okay, please, yeah.
I'm frozen, but can you hear me okay?
I can hear you well, yes.
Okay. It's a silly question, and I hope I can verbalize it correctly, but it's something that kind of makes me a little stressed sometimes. All of us here really obviously want to achieve bodhicitta. That's why we come to the teachings. We listen to teachings and study. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we are encouraged to set intentions, to dedicate, to remind ourselves that we want to achieve bodhicitta, like turning on the water, we may the blessings flow, and et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess my question is, if we don't consciously frequently set that intention of bodhicitta, like how often do we need to consciously say, I'm doing this to become a bodhisattva, or I'm doing this, you know, because we've also I think I remember hearing in the teachings that it just being a good person and acting with compassion and kindness is good, but it's not enough. that you also have to be setting these intentions. But like, how often, you know, like, right. like, oh my gosh, I forgot to set an intention. I've wasted everything I've done good today, or, you know.
Oh, my teacher, who maybe some of you knew, Lama Yeshe, my root guru, when people would come to him sort of sad that they weren't doing enough for something, he would say, good enough, dear. You know, don't beat yourself up. So, but in terms of frequency, when we talk about two things, refuge and bodhicitta, it actually mentions in the teachings to generate, you know, to take refuge again and again every day, three times in the day, three times at night. So usually we say six times. Like the Muslims have this call to prayer. They do. How many times do they do? How many times? Anyone know? Five?
Five
times?
Five.
So, yeah, it's very similar. So, and in bodhicitta, it's said to generate three times a day, during the day, you know, maybe morning, midday, afternoon, or late afternoon. Then if in the evening, when you're going to sleep, before you go to bed, maybe wake up in the middle if you have to go pee-pee, generate bodhicitta. You know, then later in that, so six times. In Tantra, there's something called the six session yoga, which sort of ritualizes that. It's said that you should do six times a day. So every 4 hours would be good. If you, that's about amount of time that you can keep in mind before you generate a bodhicitta or a refuge before it starts to become in the background of your mind. So I think I would like to petition Apple to make the watch, Apple Watch, give a beep every 4 hours, or you could set it, you know, or you put a timer, remind yourself. So that might be one way, Elise. I think it was Elise who asked that, right?
Yes.
Yeah, you know, about every 4 hours to generate, you know, to formally sit down, even if it's just for a couple of minutes, you know, a minute, like one of the prayers in the six session yoga, which is a tantric thing, but the first part is talking about the bodhisattva practice, is saying, I take refuge to the three rare supremacies from the depth of my heart, Ningne, from the depth of my heart, in order to eliminate the torment of suffering of sentient beings and lead them into enlightenment, I will generate the mind of enlightenment. And once having generated that mind, I will practice the bodhisattva deeds. Even to say that in words is good, but if you've actually meditated on those ideas over some time, saying the words can bring back the experience. When you say, I take refuge to the triple gem, you know, remembering what that means, the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, the Dharma is the actual refuge, true cessation, the true path. The Buddha is the omniscient mind that taught these. The Sangha are like the nurses that help us take the medicine of the Dharma. And, you know, when you think in order to eliminate the torment, the suffering of sentient beings and set them in stable happiness, I will generate the mind of enlightenment that wishes. The idea being, in order to do that, in order to eliminate their suffering, set them in happiness, you have to be a Buddha. So the mind of enlightenment is aiming to become a Buddha for that purpose, to eliminate suffering and bring sentient beings into happiness. And then the final line is so short, you know, it's called the shortest succession yoga. The final line says, you know, having generated bodhicitta, I will practice the activities of the bodhisattvas, the Gelwe say, the what do we say, the Jinaputra, the offspring of the conqueror, the conqueror's children. It's an epithet for the Bodhisattvas, it's a nickname for the Bodhisattvas, Buddhist children. So, yeah, maybe if you can do 3 times a day and 3 times a night or 6 times during your waking hours, that will leave at least, you know, that's sort of like a good baseline to begin with.
Well, is that helpful? Well, actually, that kind of stresses me out because...
Well, you can't do all the time.
Pardon?
You may not be able to do all the time, but at least once a day.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, what do they call it? The advices of refuge. It says to generate refuge 3 times a day, 3 times a night, and various other things like to make offerings to the Triple Gem. So easiest thing to remember, Lama Zopa always says, is when you're eating, every time you have a sip, you know, just pause a second and imagine offering that transformed into some what the Buddhas actually perceive as uncontaminated bliss, offering that to the Buddhas as a cause to, you know, acting as a substance to be able to generate these realizations. And bodhicitta, remembering the benefits of bodhicitta, which we are talking about right now, these 10 benefits that can enliven the mind to be able to do that. But I interrupted you. You were going to say I was stressing you out. What were you saying?
I guess, you know, in the course of a normal day, even though, you know, I, like many others, I forget to say those words or to vocalize those words, but, you know, I feel very strongly that that's what I want to do. And I guess analogy is like, you know, when you go to college to become a teacher, okay, you do all the work, you seek out the courses, you apply yourself to the courses, just like we come to the teachings, you know, but, and you know that you're going to be, you want to be a teacher to help kids and, you know, you keep looking for new courses and you remind yourself every once in a while that you're going to want to be a teacher. But day to day, when you're taking the courses, you're just trying to pass each course. And, you know, and then you remind yourself once in a while, but you're not thinking, you know, 3 or 4 times a day, I want to be a teacher. Right. So I'm wondering if it can be the same.
So that's enough. That, like, say, for instance, we said, I take refuge in order to eliminate torment of sentient beings and set them in bliss. I generate bodhicitta. Having generated bodhicitta, I'll practice the bodhisattva deeds. That's like being the teacher.
Uh-huh.
The bodhisattva. So if you... that presupposes that you already have the motivation to do that. Otherwise, of course, you may be going just to make money or to pay the bills or whatever, but if you have a sense to be a teacher, to help the children, or if they're adults, if you're giving adult courses to help your peers or other adults, that's already, you know, implicitly you have in your mind these causes.
Mm-hmm.
So don't flagellate yourself, don't tense up, but when you do have the opportunity, when you have a little bit of leisure to take refuge, you know, at least once a day, you know, think of what refuge actually means, that I'm, rather than relying on just the appearances of this life, reputation, pleasures, wealth, fame, and so forth, that I will rely on the holy dharma rather than the worldly dharmas. I'll rely on the holy dharma. And although the actual dharma is true cessation and true paths, in analogy to that, keeping your sense of morality, observing karma, avoiding negative actions is like taking one of the precepts of refuge.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can do that, and also with respect to bodhicitta, make offerings, some one offering every day. Sometimes you can get a little cup. You know, David and Karen gave me some offering bowls when I did my long retreat, my attempt at retreat. And there's, you know, they're still not as big as you have in the Gompa. They're, you know, little sort of Chinese tea cups. You can offer a little bit of your morning soya milk or tea or coffee or whatever. And like the Tibetans do, they before they have, they pour a little bit in the cup and they put it on the altar, symbolically making offerings, well, actually making offerings, but imagining it as the Buddha experiences it as uncontaminated bliss. Lama Yeshe used to tell me, as he used to, I don't know how many times he told me, a couple of times maybe, that in order to experience bliss ourselves, like say you want to have Dharma happiness and uncontaminated bliss of the sutra path, or the uncontaminated bliss of the tantric path, you have to offer bliss. So you can offer happiness to other sentient beings by your thoughts and wishes for them. But in particular, if you can make offerings to the Buddha and imagine how they experience that. How does the Buddha experience this little cup of tea or soy milk or whatever? Knowing from your understanding of the Dharma that he experiences it as uncontaminated bliss. Everything that he experiences is of the same taste. And that is an element in creating the cause to be able to have that kind of bliss yourself, the collection of merit. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. So anyone else, before we start, anyone else have a question, observation? Adriana, how are you doing down there? I have you in the lower right-hand corner of my screen.
Hi.
Do you have any question?
No, not yet.
Okay, so let's get to our text. So we're studying, or we're talking about the benefits of bodhicitta. The thought of this is, I mentioned my son, you know, the worldly example, the father is trying to encourage the son to get a college education. Saying if you get a college education, you'll get a good job, you'll be secure, you'll be more attractive to the opposite, to good wife or husband or something like that. Telling the benefits to encourage them to do something, so to instill that sense of pleasure and interest in the Mahayana. The doorway to the Mahayana, which is bodhicitta. We talked about the benefits of bodhicitta. So we talked about, and Geshe-la talked about also what are called these 10, bodhicitta is the doorway, or the gateway of the Mahayana. You can't call yourself a bodhisattva unless you're not even an actual Mahayanist unless you have bodhicitta. You don't have to have spontaneous bodhicitta. Maybe just wishing bodhicitta is enough. Otherwise, to call yourself, to say we're a Mahayanist, it makes no sense. So the doorway to the Mahayana, if we develop bodhicitta, we will be called a child of the Buddha. This term I said before, the Jina Putra. Jina means victor or conqueror. Putra means son. Like in India, the prince was called the Rajaputra. Have you ever heard that? There's a famous city in India. Nili, do you know? Is it? But in modern Hindi, they take off the final A's and say Rajputs.
Rajputs, yeah.
Rajput, Rajaputra. That means the son of the king, which in our language we say prince, right? Who's going to become the king. So here, the Buddha, instead of saying Rajaputra, he said Jinaputra, the son or offspring of the conqueror, which means the individual, the Buddha, who has conquered all of the delusions. So we will actually become a member of the family, Mahayana family, if we develop bodhicitta. We'll become a son or daughter of the Buddha. Third one, we will surpass the Shravakas and Pratika Buddhas. Those are the Hinayana disciples, those who are aiming for liberation. Even they may have a realization of emptiness and selflessness, and we're just a proto, just a baby bodhisattva. We excel them, what's the word, surpass them in terms of our lineage. You know, just as when a prince or princess is born, the ministers come, even the, just like the size of a hamster or something, small baby, the ministers come in their regal robes and everything to make offerings to them because they are destined to become, you know, Buddhas. So we surpass the Shravakas and Pratika Buddhas. We will become a supreme object of veneration. We mentioned a little bit about that, meaning that the gods of the desire realm and other Buddhas and Bodhisattvas will pay attention and encourage and venerate us if we have developed bodhicitta. We mentioned it is the supreme means of accumulating merits. Remember? I think that's where we were last time. I can't tell if I got my reading glasses and I've got two pairs of glasses here. Oh, here they are. If you generate the mind of bodhicitta, it becomes the supreme means of accumulating merits. We talked about these. And I wanted to make a correction last time when I read on page 448, those of you who are following, it didn't seem right, so I had to go back to the Tibetan to check. Herb, you okay? What are you doing there? Covering up your camera. Previously, when the compassionate teacher was born as the Brahmin youth named Star, that's the English translation. In Sanskrit, I think he was Taraka, something like that. Tibetan says, say, karma. When he was born as this Brahmin, so that means previous life of the Buddha when he was a bodhisattva, he was born as a Brahmin youth. Due to the text that David translated, he's translated it this way. Due to his strong attachment to a girl, he had to defer practicing celibacy for 12 years, which delayed his accumulation of merit by 10,000 eons. So if you look at the context, it doesn't make sense. This is talking about the benefits of bodhicitta. It sounds like he's given up practicing celibacy, but actually the story is a little bit different. David sort of missed a little nuance here. Actually, who has the attachment is the girl. He was born as a very handsome Brahmin, and there was one young girl who had great attachment to him. And what was that famous movie, Obsession or something? What was it? With
Glenn Close.
What was it?
Fatal Attraction.
Fatal Attraction. That's what I'm thinking of, actually. You know, sort of like unquenchable thirst. And she said that if he didn't marry her, she would commit suicide. So he had been living as a monk in the celibate life. And so he, out of compassion for her, so that she wouldn't commit suicide, he lived with her for 12 years. So the sentence should read something like this. Due to the strong attachment of the girl for him, he gave up practicing celibacy for 12 years. And then the sentence that says, the part of the sentence that says, when he, which delayed his accumulation of merit by 10,000 eons. That's not at all what it says in the text. I don't know how David got this. it says that he diminished his duration in cyclic existence by 10,000 eons. So this is actually explaining the benefits of bodhicitta, because even performing what would be generally be considered be a negative action, giving up your vows, living with a woman or a man, having been celibate before, that would generally be considered to be negative, because he did it out of compassion and bodhicitta, he actually shortened his time in cyclic existence. He got closer to eliminating the delusions by 10,000 eons. Does that make a little more sense if you look at it now? In the context of that. Okay. So we talk about that was, it, these aren't numbered here, so was, I'm not sure whether that is the third or fourth. Next one was, we will quickly purify our negative karma and obscurations. And so bodhicitta has both of these benefits. When you develop bodhicitta, it accumulates merit, but the very act of developing bodhicitta purifies negative karma. Generally, we think of them as two activities, you know, making offerings and doing good deeds to create virtue. And at other times, you apply the four opponent forces and so forth, or you do certain rituals to purify negative karma. You make prostrations to the 35 Buddhas, or you do Vajrasattva. Actually, they're related. It's just as a matter of naming. Lama Yeshe used to say they come down to almost the same thing. So we will quickly purify our negative karma and obscurations. Even for purifying negative karma and obscurations, I'm reading from page 449. Even for purifying negative karma and obscurations, bodhicitta is supreme. Even negativities that cannot be purified through the great force of confession, meaning the four opponent forces, can instantly be purified through generating bodhicitta. Bodhicharya Vatara says, our negativity is extremely powerful and enduring. Other than perfect bodhicitta, what other virtue can overcome it, can destroy it? So when you apply the four opponent forces, one of the opponent forces is called the force, the power of reliance, which means relying on refuge and relying on bodhicitta. You rely on, with respect to, if you fall down on the ground, you have to rely on the ground to get up, right? You have to get out of my chair. I'm getting old. I have to press down, you know. If you fall on the ground, you have to rely on the earth. If you fall down with regard to the triple gem, if you've created negative karma with respect to them, the way to rely on them to overcome that is by taking refuge, revivifying your refuge, you know, rather than ignoring them or, you know, contravening the vows or whatever, taking that seriously. With respect to sentient beings, when you've created negative karma with respect to sentient beings, because that those two camps cover all situations. You either create non-virtue with respect to the triple gem or with respect to sentient beings. So with respect to sentient beings, a way to rely on them is to generate bodhicitta. So when you apply the four opponent forces, if you spend some time on having that motivation for your purification. So I'm not sure exactly. I think we got around here. A historical account that also states that in India, a yogi of Guru Maitreya, you remember this from last time we talked about this? It was called Maitri Yogi. Instead of saying yogi in the Tibetan text, they say yogi. He was one of Atisha's teachers. There were three main teachers of bodhicitta to Atisha. Atisha. So this great yogi was chanting and meditating on mind training, on training the mind in bodhicitta, while singing Vajra songs, because he was also a tantric practitioner, while sitting on the banks of the Ganges River. And by training his mind in nothing other than bodhicitta, he purified a vast amounts of obscurations, as was confirmed by his direct vision of the protector Maitreya, the future Buddha Maitreya. And I told these stories last time. Also a Sangha who did the 12-year retreat, never having even a good dream. he eventually, because during that time, he was getting closer and closer to developing compassion and bodhicitta. And at the end, when he saw a mother dog with maggots in her body trying to feed her children, he tried to take out the maggots with his tongue for fear of hurting the maggots. So he wasn't just, you know, not partial to the dogs, that grabbing the maggots with a tong or something and tossing them away. He was cautious about them. Anyway, the smell was so bad, the sight was so bad, he closed his eyes and he couldn't get his tongue close, and then he looked up and there was Maitreya. So these are examples of the purificatory power of bodhicitta. Then, next one. We will easily accomplish our goals. If you have bodhicitta, this is on page 450 at the bottom. If you have bodhicitta, you will accomplish whatever you set your mind to. Those with bodhicitta will perfect whatever enlightened activities they engage in. If you do not have bodhicitta, you won't be able to do something as insignificant as merely causing it to rain when rain is scarce. Something as insignificant as that. Is that insignificant? Can you do that? Felix, can you cause rain? Where's your mom tonight? She's not here? Felix? You have to,
I'm sorry, my mother?
Yeah, I asked two questions. Is it easy for you? Can you create rain easily?
No.
No. And the second question was, where's your mother? Is she here tonight?
No, she is not.
Okay. So, do you know, is it easy to create rain? Do you know anyone who can create rain? We have people in Native American people who do rain dances, so forth and so on. There's some famous Tibetan yogis. I can't remember the particular name of one that used to be, whenever the Dalai Lama was giving teachings outside, he would come and prevent the rain from coming, you know, so that it didn't douse people. Or if there was a drought, he could create rain. The essential element of that is if you have bodhicitta, there's certain, prayers that you can do and wishes that you can make that affect the Naga realm that control, that have a certain influence on the rain and so forth. When the Tibetans were in exile, after the Dalai Lama left and the Indian government gave some places in India, there was one former concentration camp that the British had for the bad Indians, you know, that they considered bad, called Buxa. It was an infamous place, and the Indian government ceded that land to the Tibetan government for the monasteries. So many of the Tibetan monks were there together, and they continued their studies before they eventually rebuilt the monasteries in India. Lama Yeshe told me that in those early days, sometimes the local Indians would come when there was a drought and say, "Oh, Babaji, we don't have any rain. What can we do?" And Lama Yeshe said, among the Tibetan Geshes, they would come out as a group, some of whom, the understanding is some of them actually had actual bodhicitta. Maybe not everyone had spontaneous bodhicitta, but among the group, someone had, and they would do puja together, And by the time they would walk from the monastery to the place, you know, maybe an hour away, do the puja. By the time they walked back, it had begun to rain, where there had been no rain for, you know, for months. So that this kind of, in Tibetan lore, should sort of understand that when he says, if you don't have bodhicitta, you won't be able to do something as insignificant as merely causing it to rain when rain is scarce. You may think, who can cause rain? So it's sort of understood, those practitioners who have bodhicitta, this is something that can be done. If you have bodhicitta, all the collections of ritual actions and knowledge mantras, as well as proclaiming words of truth, from that sort of very sophisticated down, will be accomplished without obscuration. What are words of truth? Anyone know? See anyone's eyes lighting up?
Dharma? Would it be Dharma?
Words of truth being Dharma? I'm trying to see. I'm looking at different pages here. Who can I ask? Yoshua, have you any idea? Have you ever heard of words of truth? Herb Cunningham, you know what words of truth are? Maybe he's off making a cup of tea. No, here he is. Herb, do you know what words of truth are?
Not familiar with the term.
Okay, so all of us, there didn't seem to be anyone else. So words of truth are, for instance, what was the example? Oh, the example at the bottom, the Bodhisattva Sataparajita, which is the Bodhisattva called Always Crying. Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard of him? Always Crying. In the Prajnaparamita, in one of the three main Prajnaparamitas, we say the three mothers, there's an extensive explanation of how he created merit with respect to his guru, who was in retreat for a long time. And he would put water on the dust outside the retreat structure where his guru was doing retreat for many years. And when he ran out of scented water, he had nothing else. He even cut his arm. I think he took a bamboo, cut it, and with his blood, he sprinkled his blood to keep the dust down. This was like his kind of his kind of practice. So at a certain point, he wanted to make offerings, and he didn't have anything to make offerings with. So he even offered his body, flesh, and bones to an emanation of one of the desire realm gods, an evil god, sort of a Mara, let's say. He offered his flesh and blood, and he became, you know, helpless. And at that point, a patron, I think a lady, said, oh, don't do this. Don't kill yourself. I will provide the offerings that you need for your guru and, you know, for you to practice this guru devotion. And so she said, please revive yourself. And he said what is called words of truth. He's not the first one who said this. This is the Buddhist, in the Buddhist understanding, you know, from time immemorial. He said, if I am a bodhisattva, may my body be, be repaired, whatever the right word is. What does he say? Yeah, so it doesn't say here, but that's the story. So words of truth means by the power of your motivation, if you utter words which are absolutely true, and you say, by the power of the truth of the Dharma, by the power of the truth of the triple gem, maybe you know, I think when we make offerings, there's a kind of a cloud, what's it called? Cloud Dharani or something like this. It says, by the power of the triple gem, by the power of the truth of the great bodhisattvas and the Sitaga, may these wishes be fulfilled as I wish. You're familiar with that? Have you any seen that?
Yeah.
No. Some say yes, some say no. Okay, you may see in the FPMT prayer book when we talk about the multiplying mantras and so forth in that section, there's about the words of truth. So words of truth means when you're calling on reality to cause the events of the present to be more beneficial for sentient beings by calling on the truth. One of the great examples is mentioned here. When J. Monlam Pel, this is a Tibetan Lama who was the 8th Ganden Tipa, the throne holder of the Ganden tradition, the Gelugpa tradition. So presently we have a throne holder of the Gelugpa tradition. The 8th one, when there was a flood in Lhasa, the capital, you know, where the Potala is now, there was nothing they could do to cause the water to, they tried to build dams and everything. The water kept on coming, endangering Lhasa and other things. So it says, no one else was able to turn back the overflowing rivers, waters of the Tsangpo River. What's the Tsangpo River? Is that a river you know? Come on, who's the Indian? Nili, what's the Brahmaputra? Is it the Brahma? What's the famous? There are three main rivers that start in the Himalayas. So one goes into China. Was it the Yangtze, the Brahmaputra, and so forth? So this is the Brahmaputra, I think. The Tsangpo River. The waters of that river were overflowing. He caused the waters to recede with the words of truth. Monlam Pel is a bodhisattva. So this is only hearing that you don't understand what's happening. What he did is he wrote on a piece of paper, Monlam Pel is, by the truth of the fact that I, Monlam Pel, is a bodhisattva, may these waters recede. He tied it to a stone, put it at the edge of the waters that was coming, and the water stopped and actually began to recede. That's what that's talking about. Okay. If you read some of the other Lamrim texts that talk about these benefits, maybe these stories, you can see more elaboration about them there. Then on page 451 it says, like the king of wish-fulfilling jewels. You heard the wish-fulfilling jewel? Nico, have you heard of the wish-fulfilling jewel? Hmm. Giovanna? Okay. Wish-fulfilling jewel is something that's a possession of the Chakravartin emperors. Earlier times, when minds were very pure, there were individuals who, due to their karma, were recognized as universal emperors. We call them Chakravartin emperors. They have a wheel, you know, in the mandala offering, we say, Korlo Rinpoche, Norbo Rinpoche, Sunmo Rinpoche, Longbo Rinpoche. You know this liturgy? So, Korlo Rinpoche, Norbo Rinpoche means the precious jewel. So the Chakravartin would have karmically, he'd have possession of these amazing implements. The wish-fulfilling jewel is something that if you clean and you polish and you put on the top of a flagpole and you make prayers, all of your temporal wishes will be fulfilled. It doesn't give you bodhicitta. It doesn't prevent you from falling into hell realms, but anything in this world, if you want, you know, new clothing or a new house or food for your subjects or something, the wish-fulfilling jewel can achieve that. So this is, you might say legendary, but Buddhists believe this is something that does exist at times when it is not as dark as it is now. I don't mean at night. I mean, you know, was it not like an age of degeneration? Like the king of wish-fulfilling jewels that truly accomplishes all one's aims, like the excellent vase that thoroughly completes all of your intentions. So there are also wish-fulfilling vase, which is maybe like the Aladdin's lamp, right? So this is talking about you will easily accomplish your goal. So bodhicitta is even more efficacious than a wish-fulfilling jewel or the Aladdin's lamp. If you meditate with great force on bodhicitta, what need is there to mention that this will accomplish all other intentions? You will even effortlessly understand the teachings. Okay? Yes. So here, another correction. This next, it says, the questions of Nayarana Sutra. Actually, the sutra requested by Nayarana. You know what, who Nayarana is? Maybe Nili knows from India. Who is Nayarana? I think Nayarana is one of the forms of Shiva, the great destroyer or something like that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, this is not that Nayarana. There was an individual called Nayarana who made requests to the Buddha, you know, who's asking questions, like our question and answer period. So regarding the radiant, stainless Dharma that the great bodhisattvas desire, you know, the holy Dharma, the text says, it is a deep mine of Dharma and is hidden inside trees and even transformed into limitless scriptures. So that's not correct. Actually, the Tibetan, if you look at the Tibetan, it says, it is a Dharma treasure. And I don't know if you know the word for treasure. You know, terma. Have you heard of termas? Anyone? Some of you who maybe studied in the Nyingma tradition or the Kagyu tradition. Terma means treasure. So terma texts were texts, they're different kinds, external termas that were hidden, though maybe during the time of Padmasambhava, who came to Tibet. He left instructions with some of the disciples that they would leave certain teachings that were not suitable for the present time. They would write them down and they would hide them. And that in the future, people who had the karma would find them and would reveal those treasure texts, karmas. Have you heard this now? Some maybe have heard that. Okay. So this is what it's talking about. So regarding the radiant stainless Dharma that the great bodhisattvas desire is a karma Dharma, is a treasure of Dharma, and is hidden inside mountains, mountain caves. Here it says deep mine. Actually, mountain caves, they would sometimes leave stones with the teachings on them in caves. Padmasambhava caves, many great yogis supposedly found terma texts within them in trees. So sometimes the texts would be put in the branches of trees and even transformed into limitless scriptures that are doorways to the Dharma that now rests in your hand. So those individuals like Padmasambhava could leave these treasure texts. There are even some kinds of, what are they called, mind treasures, that some individuals, having heard teachings from Padmasambhava, he left an imprint in their mind, and sometime in a very distant life, they would have a dream or they would just have a realization that are called mind treasures, mind of your mind. Then another text, the Compendium of True Dharma, says, again, this first line is not exactly right. It says, although the conqueror Buddha does not dwell in the perfect contemplation of the Bhagavan, the Dharma may even emerge from the sphere of space and water. So that's not what it says. The Tibetan actually says, in the Bhagavan's perfect intention, You know, so not that the Buddha has, the Buddha doesn't have any thoughts, right? Buddha's mind is totally non-conceptual. So when we use, when we start talk about the Buddha's intention, that means what the Buddha is intending, even if the Dharma, okay, even if the conqueror Buddhas do not dwell in the world, there's a very, very famous kind of saying, whether the Buddhas abide or do not abide, the Dharma continues, right? So it's sort of something similar to that. The Buddha, the Bhagavan's perfect intention is that even if the Buddhas do not dwell in the world, the Dharma may emerge from the sphere of space, from a wall or a tree. So the wall or a tree is talking about these Dharma texts, you know, that there may be some text that's inserted into a wall or inserted into a tree, or in certain cases, even the Buddha's mind causing the branches of the trees to move, and the sounds that are heard by people will proclaim the Dharma. Have you heard that? In some of the, we talk about the pure realms and so forth, even the sounds of the trees proclaim the Dharma. In regard to the intention of the Bodhisattvas, their instructions, their advice that they give comes about from their own analysis of the teachings and from, and all subsequent teachings that they give emerge from that. So all of this is due to bodhicitta motivation. Therefore, if we desire enlightenment, we must first apply ourselves to the means, the methods to generate bodhicitta. Enlightenment is not possible through any other means. You cannot achieve enlightenment without generating bodhicitta. It's the heart of that path that leads to enlightenment. The Sutra of the Fortunate Aeon. What's the Fortunate Aeon? Anthony, have you heard of the Fortunate Aeon?
I can't say I've heard it off the top of my head, but I would assume that it's probably closer to when the Buddha was alive, because as we get further into the future, it says we get into like the dark times and times devolve eventually up to the point where life spans are like 8 years old and people right. are short and not so attractive.
Right. Good guess. Not, but there's this whole eon of this, what we call trikiliacosm or billion world systems. You know, when we talk about when you offer the mandala, you envision 1,000 world systems, and then 1,000 of those, 1,000 is what? Million, right? And then 1,000 of those, they call the 3,000 worlds, which actually means 1,000 cubed, right? A billion. So all of the billion world systems that are coincident with us right now, but there are other world systems way beyond that, beyond the other billions and billions. But these billion world systems, the Buddhas will arise during this fortunate eon while these systems exist. That's called the fortunate eon. The Buddha Shakyamuni was here, what, 2,500 years ago, something like that. Maybe he's presently teaching in another of these billion world systems. Later he'll be teaching in another, and this, so that's what's being mentioned. Therefore, the Sutra of the Fortunate Aeon states, first generate bodhicitta. you have to do that first. There are many such scriptural occurrences which state that all the 1,000 Buddhas of the Fortunate Aeon, so during this Fortunate Aeon, there will be 1,000 Buddhas who come to our planets. You know, what was Shakyamuni? What number was he of the 1,000 Buddhas? Anyone know? Was he the first?
No, it was fourth.
Karen, the fourth Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
it said, yeah, anyway, I'm going to just done with it. All of the 1,000 Buddhas that will come will proceed in this way. They'll all generate bodhicitta first. Then another benefit of bodhicitta, getting to the end, you will not be damaged or harmed by harm and obstacles. You will not be disturbed by harm and obstacles. Since Vajrapani was one of the, of course, is a tantric deity also, but Vajrapani was one of the 8 great bodhisattvas, right? You know the eight great bodhisattvas? Michael, have you heard of the 8 great bodhisattvas? Mm-hmm. Julie, do you know? What?
I don't know who they are, but I do know of them. But I can't remember their names.
Okay. Avalokiteshvara. My hand right here. Manjushri. Who else? Vajrapani. One of the 8 great bodhisattvas. My hand in the right direction. Skitigarbha, earth treasure, which is very famous in the Chinese tradition. Akashagarbha. Samantabhadra. One of them is called Sarva Nivarana Vishkambini. I like to joke that when, you know, his name was so much longer than all of the other of the bodhisattvas, like Vajrapani or Avalokiteshvara or something, or Manjushri. So when his mother was going, Sarva Nivarana Vishkambini, where are you? Long name. So these are the, Maitreya was one of the 8 great bodhisattvas. So Vajrapani, the 4 great kings and so forth, act as the special guardians of someone who has bodhicitta. A bodhisattva has twice as many guardians as a Chakravartin king, a universal monarch, who I mentioned has these like the precious wheel, the precious jewel, you know, like in the mandala, say, Korlo Rinpoche, Norbo Rinpoche, Sumo Rinpoche, Longpoche, these 7 possessions of the Chakravartin king, plus the wish fulfilling vase, I think they make it 8 in the mandala offering. So Chakravartin kings also have protectors naturally, bodhisattvas and spirits and so forth. But a bodhisattva has twice as many guardians as a Chakravartin king. Therefore, he cannot be harmed, or she cannot be harmed by humans, non-humans, and so forth. So Geshe Kung Lumba, does anyone know Geshe Kung Lumba? I have to look at the other screen here. No one? Okay. Geshe Kung Lumba was one of the Kadampa Geshes. He has a present reincarnation in Madison, Wisconsin. He was one of the translators along with Sherpa Tulku. They call him Kamlung Rinpoche. He was one of the translators of a lot of the books at the Tibetan Books Works and Archives, along with John Landau and Alex Berzin. If you ever see those, you'll see Kamlung Rinpoche. So in his previous life, he was Geshe Kung Lumba, one of the Kadampa Geshes. Kung Lumba also states that wherever one stays after developing bodhicitta, it would be improper for humans and non-humans of that place to inflict harm on such a person, and that they will even come to have affection for him. Geshe Kung Lumba was also called the Crying Lama, not like the Sadhuparadita that we talked about before, the Prajnaparamita, but you know, he would meditate in the cave on the suffering of the spirits that were, you know, coming and causing harm. And after some time, they felt such shame that this person they were trying to harm was actually crying for them, that they stopped harming him. In the Array of Stalks Sutra, the Ganda Vyuha Sutra, it declares, child of the lineage. What does that mean, child of the lineage? Anyone know? Linda, do you know? Have you heard that?
I've not heard that, but I would assume it's a practitioner of the past.
Yeah, of the Mahayana path. There was a, the Buddha referred to the, you know, Kula Putra. Kula means family or as a lineage. So child of the lineage, child of the family means the Mahayana family, someone who's developed bodhicitta. It is like this. For example, there is an elixir, a nectar called unforsaken, and if you hold on to that elixir, you will not incur any harm or fear from others. You will not receive any harm or fear from others. Likewise, if a bodhisattva also holds on to the elixir of bodhicitta, he or she will not incur any harm or fear from samsara. So it brings about the great fearlessness. There are many scriptures which state that you cannot be afflicted by harms and obstacles if you have bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is also the very best for purifying the two obscurations together with their imprints. So I'm just going to mention the other two names so we have a couple of minutes and take your questions. We'll talk about them next time. You'll quickly complete all the grounds in the paths if you have bodhicitta. If you wonder, how long will it take before I reach the path of preparation of this? If you have bodhicitta, it comes more quickly. You will become a field that produces every happiness and well-being for migrating beings. I'll give a little explanation of that next time. And then we'll begin the actual way to develop bodhicitta. Once you've been encouraged to the benefits of bodhicitta, then you ask, well, okay, bodhicitta has all these benefits. How do I develop it? So then we'll talk about that. So before we finish, anyone have any questions or observations or corrections?
I have a question, Venerable George.
Yes. I don't see who's talking.
It's Neely.
Oh, it's Susie. Yeah.
Neely.
Oh, Neely. Yeah.
So in my Hindi and my Sanskrit isn't very good, but I've always understood Bhagavan to mean God, and I've heard it used multiple times in the text for Buddhism.
Say that again. I missed the
word Bhagavan.
Bhagavan.
I've always understood it to mean God, but it seems like they're referring to the Buddha when they use that.
Yeah. So Bhagavan. Nowadays you say Bhagavan. Who was the famous Indian who came to Oregon in the United States? Bhagavan Rajneesh, right?
Yeah.
So Bhagavan, usually in Sanskrit, one of the meanings of Bhagavan was Lord, you know, so like somewhat high. I suppose even on some estates or tea plantations, the workers would call the owner Bhagavan, essentially he's the one in charge or something. But the Buddhism also used the word Bhagavan as an epithet for the Buddha. And in Tibetan, the way that they translated into Tibetan Bhagavan was Chom Dan De. So there were three ideas. So Chom means someone who has destroyed the afflictions, the delusions. Den means having all of the good qualities, Chom Den De, and someone who has passed beyond cyclic existence. Lama Zopa Rinpoche used to translate it as the endowed transcendent destroyer. Maybe some of you read some of the earlier books, Bhagavan. But it's a word that was used in India, in the Hindu tradition, the Vedic tradition, generally to mean someone who is endowed with many good qualities, or like the boss, the head. Okay. Anyone else? I'm not sure if it's a good sign or a bad sign that you don't have any questions. Probably a good sign, right? Yeah, Peter says yes. Adriana has the courage to ask a question. You have to unmute, Adriana.
When we talk about the delusions, we're talking about the main delusions and then the other more subtle, correct?
Secondary delusions, yeah, right? There, the Buddha said that there were 84,000.
Okay. Okay. I just wanted to make sure if it was like 20-something or the 84,000.
Right. So, yeah, the 84,000 can be condensed into a smaller number that can be condensed into the sixth root delusions. Those can be condensed into the the three poisonous minds and so forth.
Okay.
When we were receiving teachings from Geshe Darge at the Library of Works, Tibetan Works and Archives, maybe in 1975, Geshe-la began saying, there are 84,000 delusions. The first is attachment. And I remember John Lando sitting looking around and sharpening his pencil like, oh boy, this is going to take a while. 84,000.
Yes.
And so, you know, Geshe-la explained about attachment, then about anger, and then about ignorance. And he said, all the other 84,000 can be condensed into these three. And I think there was an audible sigh in the room. We just missed the bullet. We don't have to write down all 84,000.
But I mean, okay. It can be accomplished. So
yes,
through bodhicitta. So
yes.
Okay, good.
Linda, you've unmuted. Does that mean you have a question? Yeah.
Yes. Well, I am relaying a question from YouTube that was put in the chat from a student who's watching via YouTube. He asked, you should at least cherish greatly these four root vowels and the fifth about alcohol. Even among these, alcohol and women are extraordinarily destructive. Could you explain the capitalized area?
I'm not sure what's capitalized because I don't see the capitals there, but I assume when it says that.
Oh, capitalized areas, women.
And alcohol.
And women are extraordinarily destructive.
Okay. They're extraordinarily destructive for men. Men are extraordinarily destructive for women. Remember we were talking at the beginning, the first disciples of the Buddha were all the monks. So all of these things about women were admonitions to the monks not to give up their vows because of attraction to women. If it were a case that the Buddha were teaching women to women, say nuns, who had taken vow of celibacy, the Buddha would, instead of saying women there, he would say men are incredibly destructive for women. Now you may say, you know, with our, you know, we like, we, you say, if without men and women, we wouldn't have families, I wouldn't have been born, you know, how can the Buddha be saying that? We're talking about someone who is aiming to achieve the great spiritual realizations of the path, and there are certain circumstances when there are, you know, lay practitioners where you have families and so forth, but it's considered to be the people that are considered to be most quick on the path are those who have divested themselves of the family life so that have gone forth into ordination and so forth. So that admonition about women is for the monks, the admonition about men would be for the women. About alcohol, of the five lay vows, what are the five lay vows? Anyone know? Jill, do you know the five lay vows? Do you have the five lay vows?
Yep. No lying.
No lying.
No stealing.
No stealing. You're starting with the less important one. What's the,
yeah, I'm not getting them in order.
Let's say killing, no killing.
No killing. No stealing.
No lying. And what?
No sexual misconduct. No
sexual misconduct.
No intoxicants.
No intoxicants, which you hear means alcohol. At the time of the Buddha didn't talk about ganga, or is it ganja? What is it called? Marijuana or, you know, other things. He talked about alcohol. So of those five, which which of them, if you take, say, if you don't take all five, you can take some, or you can take, you know, the majority, or you can take all of them. Which one do you have to take? This is a brain teaser.
Not kidding.
I can't hear. Someone's saying something?
No killing.
No killing.
No killing, right? That's what modern lamas say. But actually in the Vinaya, when it's taught what the Buddha said, the one vow you have to take is no intoxicants, no alcohol. So that's why, where was it, Linda or someone saying that, why, reading the question, why was alcohol considered capitalized or more important or whatever? The idea is this. You know the famous story of the one bodhisattva who living in a cave. I'm getting some cross talk here. Some bodhisattva who was living in a cave, and there was a woman, like the story we told before about the bodhisattva who gave up his ordination for 12 years to live with her because she was going to commit suicide. Similar kind of story, but a different story. A woman said, you know, he wouldn't have sex with her. She wanted to sleep with him. And he said no. And she said, well, if you don't, you will, you know, I will kill myself. You either have to drink this alcohol or kill this goat that she brought or have sex with me. And there was something else, I can't remember. And so he thought of the other things. You know, if he had sex with her, he would break his monk's vows. If he killed a goat, he would break his monk's vows. So he thought, of these, maybe the alcohol is the least destructive. So he drank the alcohol, got inebriated, and as a result of that, he ended up killing the goat, having dinner with her, and then having sex. So all of them were gone. So it's said that of the five vows, according to Vinaya, the one you have to take is no intoxicants, and then you add to that. But nowadays, Lama Yeshe used to say when he gave ordination to lay people, you know, the five precepts, many people, say Italians, you always have wine with the family. If you didn't have wine, you would be an outcast. So Lama said, you know, generally when you take refuge, the one prohibition is not to kill. Not the one prohibition, but the most important prohibition is not to kill, not to take life, not to harm. So he took that as the principle that you had to take that vow not to kill. But generally, of the five precepts, the one that, in the time of the Buddha, the one that you was capitalized or principle was not to take intoxicant, not to take alcohol. Okay? So, we've run out of time. Thank you for your attention. We have created some virtuous karma tonight. Maybe a great deal, maybe more than, you know, many people in the world create in their entire lifetime. We've created just this evening by having tried to set a very special motivation and by listening with intention, contemplating the thoughts and, you know, trying to hold that in mind with meditation. So let's dedicate that merit. Sit comfortably again, as we did at the beginning. Relax your body and mind and contemplate these virtues that we have created tonight. Due to the force of the bodhicitta motivation, the whole class, all of the activities that we motivated listening to the class became virtuous, even when our mind wasn't remembering that bodhicitta motivation. Think of all the merits you've created in previous lives, earlier this life and previous lives, all the merit that you will create in the future. Put that all together and think, may that not simply ripen in some short-lived, samsaric, contaminated happiness. There'll always be some happiness involved in that, but may it not be exhausted in that alone. Whatever way it ripens, may it become the cause of my continued spiritual development, year by year, life by life, developing bodhicitta, renunciation, the wisdom that realizes emptiness, all the stages, the paths and stages leading to Buddhahood. May it become the life force of that. May I dedicate these merits. I wish it to, that these merits ripen in my eventual achievement of enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. Due to these merits, may I quickly become a Guru Buddha, and as a result of that, lead each and every sentient being effortlessly, spontaneously, and without error into that very same state of enlightenment. Thank you very much. It's nice to see you all. We'll have a class on Sunday. Geshe-la is still on staycation. And if you have time, join us. Otherwise, hope to see you again next week. And if you have questions, maybe you could send them to Donna if you're too shy to ask during class, and she could forward them to me. Otherwise, thank you very much.
Thank you, Venerable George.
Thank you, Linda. Thank you, Donna.
Bye.
Good night.